Not a one of our girls is wrapped or worrying about an injury. And I'm looking over at our opponent, who are a very high caliber team. And I think they had 7 or 8 like hamstring and quad wraps and things like that. And it showed in the game.
Welcome to the First Beat Sports Podcast, where we talk with coaches and sports scientists to explore the latest in how performance monitoring is making a difference in the NCAA and pro sports alike. We're going to connect you with practical advice from the best in the business to help you take your athletes to the next level. On the line today is Mark Egner. Mark is Associate Head Field Hockey Coach at the College of William & Mary. He's also worked with USA Field Hockey and in with the national youth teams in his native Ireland. Among the topics Mark will discuss are building team culture, load management, and developing athletes beyond hockey. So let's get started. Here's your host, Head of First Beat Sports USA, Benjamin Jensen.
Well, hey, Mark, thanks for being on the podcast with us today.
Not at all, Ben. Thanks a million for having me.
And just a big congratulations to you. You are a first foreign coach to hop on the podcast with us. We're very happy to have you here.
I really appreciate that. And I have to apologize in advance because I'm going to sound like another American coach. But I promise I am Irish. I've lost a lot of my accent over my time here in the U.S. But I'm from Cork. It's Féidir Lá Mé Leabhar do Scaoilge. So I can speak a little bit of the hometown tongue. So I promise I'm authentic.
Yeah, I promised the staff here when I told them, yeah, he's Irish. And they said, whoa. And I said, don't worry. I can understand him. So I think we're going to be okay.
We'll try our best.
Let me know
if I need to slow down.
All right. Already congratulated you once, but huge congratulations for the nice weekend you just had. Last two games you had, beating a number 5 team in the nation in overtime, picking up a couple wins, and looks like you're nationally ranked now, kind of maybe not official yet, but where are you at right now in the rankings?
Well, first off, Ben, thanks a million. The girls have been working really, really hard, and to get the result we had on Thursday night against Louisville is just testament to the work they've been doing. I think, based off of what our sports information director was telling me, we're falling in and around number 20 in the RPI, which should be published tomorrow. It's always nice for the team to get recognition from other coaches, too. One of the cool things about the coaching environment here in the U.S. is that it's very much a community, so it's been cool to see. First of all, Louisville were incredibly gracious and quite kind to us post-game in both their interviews and just in face-to-face conversation, but also then to see the outpouring of congratulations from teams in conference and out of conference. It's been really, a really fun experience for us as coaches, but also I'm assuming for the girls to get that recognition, which they very much deserve.
All right. Yeah, I think that's well deserved. Before we get into your current role at William & Mary, you've had quite a unique coaching background that spans two continents. Can you just talk us through your career pathway?
I'll try my best, but it could be a long and winding road. So I'm from a very unique family in Ireland. I grew up 0.5 mile from our local hockey club, Cork Harlequins, which was right smack bang between the house I grew up in and my grandparents' house. It's about 1 mile of a difference between the two houses. So, and then when I was 16 and starting to move into the senior cycle of secondary school education in Ireland, there was an assumption from the club and just even internally that you give back, because hockey had given me a lot of great opportunities. So I started getting back in coaching with the club, with the youth section. It was funny because I have glasses, and at the time the Harry Potter movies were popular. Some of those girls would call me Harry Potter. And then, so then when I was away in college, I started playing for Railway Union Hockey Club in Dublin, and I was studying primary school teaching, which is akin to elementary education. And again, for me, the club was becoming a new community, and the way that I saw myself being able to give back was to participate in coaching. So I started working with the youth sections in the club on the boys' side, and then when I was 21, which seems like an age ago now, they asked me to help out with some of the senior women's teams. So at that stage, I was working with what I had been told was for 4 or 5 weeks, give us a dig out while the coach is in Tokyo and she comes back from her holiday, you can go back to just playing. And that turned into coaching them for a full season and then working with their second 11 the following season and then moving on and just staying involved in coaching. I caught this bug because at the time, the big thing for me was helping to orchestrate those eureka moments. That moment when you're watching someone on the field and they look at you and go, I get it now. I remember vividly a game where I was saying to one of our forwards, hey, I need you to make this kind of a movement. And she's like, Mark, I'm holding my lead so that there's space outside for me to get to the ball so that I can attack in that space. And I was like, man, it's finally clicking. And those moments as a coach are really, really cool. So then that stuff with the regional team with my brother grew and advanced. And through that, I met Richie Malone, who was the Irish under-18s coach. And he asked me if I wanted to come out and give him help with some sessions. So it's kind of the guy running around, picking up balls, putting out cones, doing whatever is needed. And over time, that role grew. And I was appointed as one of the assistant coaches a couple of years later. And then from there, I ended up having to step down due to family commitments and was lucky enough to get involved with an interim coaching staff for the senior women in 2012, right after the London Olympics. For the Champions Challenge. So I was just the video guy. I was very much the lowest coach on the rung, but it was a cool experience. I got to travel with them to Scotland in the preparation and help out wherever was needed. And that was with them when Dennis Pritchard and Arlene Boyles, who's still on staff with the Irish women, and helped them to their silver at the World Cup last year. And when I was 21, I came to the States for a summer and just did a little bit of work with summer camps with a guy called Bill Gaudette, who recommended that I look into this as a possible career. And at the time, I was still in my third year of college, so I still had a full year and a bit to go. But I kept an eye on the websites and started reaching out to coaches that I'd met over, or that I had players that I had worked with who were working with them. And I was very lucky that Paul Caddy at UConn and Ryan Elliott, who at the time was at the University of Richmond, and some other coaches would just engage me in conversation. We'd have a Skype conversation. It was through those kind of links and bridge building that I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to go and work at Longwood University for Ian Byers back in 2013. And when that opportunity came, I was in a break in my career as a teacher. And I was thinking, hey, I don't know that I really want to do this long term. At the time, I felt almost like I had an addiction issue because I would work to fund my habit of coaching. I would be rushing out the door at the end of the day as soon as I'd finished all my work in the classroom to go and coach anywhere I could. So the possibility for coaching one team 7 days a week was just too much to turn down and to step away from. So moved over in 2013, and I've been in the U.S. I'm in my seventh season within the NCAA system now.
Well, I have to say, this isn't something I'd normally say to somebody, but I'm actually glad you followed your addiction there. Obviously, some passion there, and you've done a good job of working your way up from video coordinator to associate head coach now at the NCAA level. So now at William & Mary, what does a typical week look like for you as the associate head coach?
Well, it would depend very much on the phase of the year we're in. The NCAA system, obviously, we're a fall sport. So that's the phase we're in right now, and that's our competitive season. So within a regular week, let's talk like today, usually on a Monday, we tend to have a recruit or two on campus. So we'll come in early in the morning on a Monday, have some meetings with them, set them up with some things. They'll spend a lot of time with the team. And then during that time, we'll be looking back at our games from the weekend and building a plan for the week going forwards. Tuesday morning, earlier in season, we would be on the field at 8 a.m. and the girls would be going through some conditioning exercises. And then we would practice Tuesday afternoon. And then that time in between conditioning in the morning and practice in the afternoon, it's an office-based job. One of the things that we put a lot of time and attention into is our scouting processes for the teams that we're getting ready to play and our individual team review meetings that we've implemented this year. So every Tuesday and Wednesday, each of the girls are required to schedule a 15-minute video debrief where the girls will come in and meet with a member of the coaching staff if they're choosing. There's an expectation that they'll come in with two or three clips from their games that they've played over the weekend with questions and say, hey, I want to look at this particular clip. Here's why. I think I got this right. Am I right in thinking that I should have pushed her in this direction? Or the idea there is that we need to involve reflection in our learning cycle so that after the athletes have had that experience, watched themselves back, thought about what they've done, that we really firm up that idea of, are we on board with what is expected as a member of this team? And then Wednesday is a similar day to Tuesday. The girls are in the weight room at 8 a.m. and they go to class all day. We're in the office preparing for the games at the weekend, preparing for practice in the afternoon. Sometime between 3:30 and 6 on a Wednesday, we have practice. Usually we will play a game on a Friday and a Sunday. So in the lead up to the Friday game, we don't show any footage of the team we're playing on Sunday. We just show footage of ourselves and footage of the team we're playing Friday. Thursday, we have no morning exercise, nothing in the morning, a lighter practice Thursday evening. Wednesday is very much our heavy day. That's when we have a little bit of speed work built into our practice, when we do a lot of weight training. Thursday is a lighter session. It's a little bit shorter. Usually that's where we put most of our video, but it just depends on the week. And then Friday we play, usually Friday evenings. So Friday morning can be a bit of a weird day. If we're on the road, it's getting the team up, going for a walk, making sure that they're doing something. Because if they're at school, they're walking around campus, they're going to class, they're experiencing things, their body's moving. But if we're on the road and we're just in a hotel, there's a real possibility that they might think, hey, I'll sleep in a little bit, which would be great. But then that sleep in just becomes staying in bed and watching Netflix and not giving their body any sort of a physical stimulus to get them out of the kind of funk that you get in with a long bus trip on a Thursday evening. Mm. And then Saturday is very much a light, light, light session. Historically, we've put yoga on a Saturday, a very light walkthrough with the team. And again, a bit of a video review of the game on Friday, if there's anything striking that we need to show the team, but mostly just here are the things we need to know about the team we're playing tomorrow. These are their big, big tendencies. This is what's necessary. But mostly a week would involve a lot of time spent in and around the team, a lot of video, and then putting time and thought and attention into our training load monitoring, making sure we're not overloading our athletes or underloading them. We have a couple of different systems that we use to track their acute chronic work ratio to make sure that we're not doing the athletes a disservice, that we're planning appropriately based on when the games are falling and who we're playing and how challenging a game should be. And then we meet with our athletic trainer and our strength and conditioning coach every Monday morning to make sure that we have a realistic picture of where each athlete is from a physical standpoint. And then we have check-ins with our academic staff as the year goes on. Like, we just finished a round of midterms, so we get a quick feedback. Hey, here's how these girls are doing. Maybe check in with so-and-so. She had a couple rough grades there. Make sure she's doing okay. And it's just a lot of just being aware of what's going on the team and where each athlete is in their life. For our seniors right now, we have a number that are hoping to play overseas when they're finished. So meeting with them to talk about opportunities that we're finding for them to see if we can find somewhere where they can continue to play the game after they graduate.
Okay, that sounds like a full week. No sleep for the weary there. I mean, you've got recruits, video, practice, strength, checking on grades, and then at the same time, already looking ahead for those seniors. Wow, I don't know how you do that, but well done. So as far as the program, dramatic improvement from year one, 7-12, your first season, to a historic 2018 conference championship, first ever NCAA tournament. You've obviously just kind of built on that momentum with this year. How did you guys make this happen at William & Mary?
So there's a couple of things that I think are important to know. First of all, William & Mary is where collegiate hockey started in America. So there's a lot of history in this program. When you have a program that's been around for 100 years, like ours was last year, there have been incredible peaks and deep valleys. And we had some very special players graduate in the early 2000s. And some of the things that are really important for people to understand about our program is that at that time, Tess, who's our head coach now, was on staff with the team in the lead up to that phase, and then left to go and work with the national team. At that stage, the program went to a number of NCAA appearances. They were ranked highly on a national level. And when I arrived here, that was the phase that Tess and I talked about a lot. What were the characteristics of that team? What were the differences between that team and where we are now? What did we need to make sure that we kind of held on to from that experience? And what do we need to do to the program now to help us get back there? We had all the raw ingredients that were necessary. We had a really eclectic bunch of people who were unique and different and talented, and it was about making those talents shine. And then we had the physical ingredients to get there too. So it was very much just about sharpening our tools and putting the work in. Now, unfortunately, my first season, we were besieged by unexpected and challenging injury setbacks that really impacted on that season. Within the space of a 3-game period, both of our center mids had a broken bone in their lower arm. One was right in the wrist and one was in the hand, I think, which meant that the core of our group, like the players who were playing in the center and getting us off to a good start, suddenly disappeared. And that was what led in a big way to us going 1-5 in conference, which was a rough, rough start. It was that we didn't make the conference tournament. We only had one win. And we kind of at the end of the year looked at things and said, okay, for us to guarantee that we'll be in the conference tournament next year, that year, JMU, Delaware, and Northeastern were all top 20 ranked programs. So we said, we need to target being a top 20 program. What are the characteristics of a top 20 program? They are physically capable. They are tactically astute, technically talented. Those are the things we need to target as areas of growth for our team to look like another top 20 program. And then the other thing that when I arrived here was that Tess and I spoke and she said, I don't want this program to just be about hockey. So we looked at ways that this program could be about developing people and preparing these athletes for what was going to come after school. So we put into place a workshop series where we work with our sports psychologist, a campus nutritionist, our career center here on campus. And that happens right at the start of every spring, where each athlete group meets with those people in their year group and we get the opportunity to feedback on the year that's just happened for them to have have an open space to talk about their feelings and about what their experience was in that previous season. And then our team talks very much about what we want the next season to look like, what we want our team to be known for. We established clear core covenants as a team, but then we also targeted those areas that we thought would help us catch up with the top 20 and maybe push past some of the programs that were around us. So we reached out to contacts we had developed over our careers, spoke at length with the University of Connecticut, University of North Carolina, Penn State University about where they were targeting growth for their athletes from a physical standpoint. USA Field Hockey is a tremendous resource for coaches in the NCAA because at the end of every season, they have a coaches forum. And at the time, there was a lot of talk about physical prep. So we were able to really put some time and attention into where are we now from a physical standpoint and what are the benchmarks we need to hit? How do we go about closing that gap? And we kind of put all that stuff together and we keep putting stuff like that together for our team. One year we had campus police come and teach our girls how to change a tire because that's an important life skill.
So, wow, okay.
A lot of it has been trying to create a more holistic approach to athlete development, but also making sure that we were targeting growth in the areas that were really, really going to help us get where we need to go. And then the last piece is we continue and we strive every year to out-develop and out-recruit the team that was here the year before. So that's built on this idea that we want to develop sustainable success. And I don't think that sustainable success can be built on a star player. When people watch our team play, it looks like a team. There's a lot of fluid interchange of positions. Everyone is sharing the weight rather than it being, hey, we give the ball to this one player and they do the work. And that was something that was a big emphasis for us. We actually had quite a strong emphasis both placed on injury reduction, and that's been something that has been really key for us. We have, touch wood, we've had one player miss a game this year, which was down to a choice by the coaching staff to rest them rather than that they were actually injured. And we are 15 or 16 games into the season right now. So we've been putting a lot of time and effort into making sure that we do the things early to make sure that the athletes are available for the games when they're needed.
Wow, that's a solid injury report right there. Well, I think it's safe to say from what you just told us that it's definitely more than just the hockey there. I mean, they're going to leave with a degree and having a good experience with you, and they're going to change a tire. So that's...
Well, you know, they might get a puncture on the way off campus.
Hey, you never know. That's a good point. You were talking about tactical stuff there, and I kind of wanted to go a little bit into, so you've got a reputation for building strong defenses. Is there any secrets for the coaches out there? Kind of what do you do that makes your defense click?
Well, first of all, I would say that we try to help our athletes understand. We don't make them do anything. You can't make anybody do anything. But we try to grow and deepen our level of understanding of what defending is and what it looks like when it's done effectively and where it happens. The sport of hockey is unique in that you have to be within a 16-yard circle of the goal to score. So if we want to defend effectively, priority one is don't let them into that circle. Then they can't score. So we talked post-game yesterday about we want to be a team who plays the whole game in the opposition's half of the field. We want to put relentless pressure on them so that they can't hurt us. And that's a big piece of how we play, is that we try to dominate the ball, try to maintain possession, because if we have the ball, the other team just flat out cannot score. It's a physical impossibility. Our forwards understand that their role is critical in our ball repossession strategies. So when we scout an opponent, we'll say, okay, here are their tendencies, here's how they play. In our preparation for a team, we'll say the key thing for this game is that our forwards are going to be responsible for these players on their team. If they do that, it means that our midfielders can be responsible for these areas. We'll be able to generate a positive overload for our team defensively in this space. That's where we should win the ball, but we could win it higher up than that space if everyone does their job right. If all of that happens, we don't have to worry about what's happening right in front of our goal. And then inside our circle and close to our circle in that defensive quarter of the field, we have very simple principles that our defensive structure is based on. I'm not going to share all of those, unfortunately.
Those are the secrets we couldn't get out of you right now then, huh?
But a lot of it would be not overcomplicating things. For me, defending is about control. Well, I have a phrase that I use, which is push, don't chase. If you're defending, you want to be in a situation where you're between the attacker and where they want to go, pushing them away. If you find that they are in control, that means you're running after them. Something's gone wrong. At that moment, do not chase. Find a position from which you can reestablish control and you can push. If everyone is operating off of that viewpoint, somebody else can push and you can get into a position behind where you can cover them. For example, we played a team early in the season who were quite talented at scoring at the back post. So in our preparation for that game, we talked about the ball is on this side. You guys on the other side of the field are our key in this game. You need to make sure your hips are open. You're aware of where the ball is. You're aware of where your player is. And she doesn't touch the ball. So on our team, we talk about that the side of the field that the ball is on is the ball side, and the other side is called the help side. And we said in this game, our help side defenders are the ones who are going to be the most important. The help that they give means that your job gets easier on that side because we're taking away their way that they like to score. It really comes down to everyone taking a personal responsibility and driving excellence when we defend. So that was just taking pride. My favorite little acronym, I apologize.
It sounds like you've really got some detailed structure there, but at the same time, I think you emphasized two or three times there of just keeping it simple. So they're playing, but everybody understands where they need to be at this point in time.
If I was to say, like, the importance in coaching is to find a way to take something that's complex and make it simple. Mm.
You've also worked with some extremely talented young players like Aaron Menges and Christy Vandenkamp. Both ended up being defensive players of the year in 2017 and 18, respectively. Can you just briefly tell us, what were the kind of the main traits that they had, physical or mental, that made them such special players?
Well, we're very lucky that Christy is still with us. So she has a couple games left in her career. But I would say they're two of, and not the only two, but two of the most dedicated players that I've worked with in terms of their attention to their preparation for their craft. Christy, still being on the team, she will be in a coach's office, online, watching video, getting prepared to make sure that she understands what she should be ready to expect. But also just when we play or when we're at practice, she's someone who drives intensity and drives the standard of what we do. Aaron was a very similar player. And I think it's something kind of built in that they had when they arrived. It's not something that they have grown in during their time at William & Mary. It's a natural trait. It's, hey, I know that we can do this. I want to help us do this. What you're doing isn't going to help us get there. Let's push it together. Interestingly, they're very, very different players, but there are some similarities. They're both players who are comfortable in possession of the ball, both players with good vision, good technical ability, and both players who maybe play a little bit deeper for us than they play when they play for the U.S., and a perseverance to be the best that they could be and to take the sport to wherever they wanted it to go for them.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like those are the traits that you'd want for defensive players of the year. Okay, let's go ahead and hit the quick fire round real quick. Have a little bit of fun here. I'm just going to shoot some questions and just throw the first answer that comes your way.
Go for it.
All right. Favorite athlete growing up?
Roberto Carlos.
All right. Guilty music pleasure?
Oh, Friday by Rebecca Black. That's
a bad song. Good one. That's an interesting one. Yep. Best game that you've been involved in as a player or a coach?
Oh, that's a tricky, tricky one. I think possibly the U19 National Futures Championships. It was about 4 years ago. We were a regional team from our area, and we were very much not expected to do well at this tournament, and we ended up winning. It was cool because that group of players were just a ton of fun to be around, and three of them had their senior day here at William & Mary yesterday. So it was the start of our William & Mary adventure together.
Okay, very cool. Irish food or American food?
Irish food.
Okay. Favorite TV show?
Game of Thrones up until last season.
So the last season just didn't cut it for you.
It wasn't quite where we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Also, the All or Nothing series on Amazon Prime. That's a great way to get an understanding of what happens in sporting environments.
Maybe biggest influence, biggest mentor in your career to date?
Yeah, Mick McKinnon. He's the guy who got me into coaching back in Ireland.
And if you could choose a superpower, what would it be?
Teleportation.
All right, let's turn over a little bit here towards your work with First Beat. So this is your fourth year using the First Beat sports system, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Just give us a little bit. How is the system implemented with the program?
It's changed every year, and it's becoming more and more a part of what we do. Although this year, it's been a teeny, teeny bit different. So the girls wear their monitors to everything they do, and we try to track everything we can. There are moments that we do with the team that we maybe miss a small individual session or something like that. But for the most part, when the whole team is doing something, whether it's lifting, running, or practice session, or a game, we wear our monitors. The biggest things that we look for with our athletes are their training load. So looking at their trip scores. And then up until this current season, we have used the QRT twice a week on a Tuesday morning and a Saturday morning, which would be our first point of contact post-game. We use it a little bit differently depending on the situation. So the main thing we look at, as I said, is their training load. And then we use that as a tool for us to have conversations with our athletes. What we try to do right now is after every session, I'll take our individual trim scores and get a team average for the session, and then build a 7-day versus 28-day acute chronic rolling ratio for our team, just to make sure that we're not overloading or underloading our athletes. In addition to that, then we'll have a quick look post-game or post-practice at a particular athlete if I feel that they could be giving a little more, or, you know, if maybe, oh, wow, that one looks like it really stressed her out. Like, let's see what happened there. And it's been interesting because, like I said, every year we've looked at different things and talked about different things with our girls. So the first thing that we talked about with them is that this is a tool. This will not be the only tool that informs our decisions, but it's a piece of the puzzle that we're using. The girls get really stressed about the color scheme sometimes, which is kind of fun. They'll be like, oh, I'm not in the red. And I'll be like, okay. And then, but that's a bad thing. And I go, well, is it?
Okay, you know, you could have a little fun there and just change the color coding scheme on them, right? They wouldn't know what was going on.
It would definitely catch them out.
So yeah, you mentioned TRIMP there. We always like to talk about the TRIMP numbers everybody's getting. Is there a number that you try to stay below, like for the week? You know, a lot of the soccer programs might try to stay below 1,000. Maybe more anaerobic-based sports might see more about 750 is kind of what they want to stay at for TRIMP. So do you have a week value? And then what are some numbers you might see from certain positions from a game?
First of all, we have moved away from a particular target number to a acute to chronic focus most of the time, because we feel if we have developed the base properly, we should be pretty good no matter what. Now, what we generally target is that we approach games from below that 750 line so that we have the capacity to tip over it, but that we're not approaching a game from an overloaded state. Our goalkeepers, their toughest part of a game for our goalkeeper will be the warm-up, because they face more shots there than they ever face, because we try to give our field players an awful lot of shots to get them ready to potentially score goals. Mm-hmm. So it will be a huge peak for them from a TRIMP standpoint. And then they drop and their heart rate stays pretty low during the game unless they get into quite a stressful moment. It is primarily an aerobic sport. We see a lot of interesting things when we look at our reports. It's very clear when an athlete is on the field or off the field, because their heart rate spikes as soon as they cross the line. What we find is that as players get older, the extent of the spike decreases. So the nervousness and the anxiety that comes with being a freshman in the second game of the season, as soon as you cross the line, the heart rate jumps and they go, oh my gosh, I'm so worried, I don't want to mess up. To by the time they're at game 18 of their senior season, they're on the field and they are in a recovery space sometimes and moving up slowly because they don't need to. They're not as stressed about that experience.
Mm-hmm. One of your players that plays like high minutes, what would a typical game maybe give you? 150, 200?
So when we track from the start of warm-up until the end of a game. For example, when we got off the field yesterday, I looked at our scores, and because it was a game that went to double overtime after a game that had gone to double overtime, we had scores in the high 200s for some of our athletes who had played significant chunks of the game and significant chunks of that overtime period. And that would be uncharacteristic for us.
All right. And from my experience working with some of the programs, I see communication can really make or break a lot of programs. How do those lines work with not just the field hockey staff, but also with the strength and conditioning staff there working with the field hockey program at William & Mary?
So this is where our department has made a big move towards what they're calling their high performance model. And we've rolled out an internal load monitoring system that we use within the team based on RPE multiplied by time. And in addition to that, we augment that with our first beat information. So we get an internal load number from first beat, and then we get a perceived load number from the athlete themselves. And then we try to balance the two of those to make sure that we are keeping a realistic picture of the puzzle. With our performance staff, so that's our strength and conditioning, our athletics performance coach and our athletic trainer, and sometimes our sports psychologist, and then our coaching staff, we meet once a week and we talk about each athlete, where they are in their journey, where they are from a physical standpoint, if they have any injuries, what sort of an impact should that have on their ability to participate in strength and conditioning sessions, in practice sessions, all of those things. We have some girls who are returning from serious injuries, who are redshirting, and they have limitations on what they can and can't do in the weight room, how we're managing their training load on the field, how many extra pieces of hockey they can have in their weeks to replace the fact that they're not participating in games. And we try to work on an individualized level within a team construct. The other thing that we do is we track week-to-week load on a periodized scale. Our plan had been for our first week of preseason to be no more than 60% of our expected load at the end of the season. So to build slowly rather than to jump right in and overload our athletes in preseason. And that was a new approach that was kind of encouraged due to the NCAA heat acclimatization recommendations, but also just because we were trying to minimize injuries and also make sure that we were ready to peak at this phase of the season. So we targeted October 4th as our first peak point because that was when our conference play started. And that was the day we played JMU and we beat them 7-2. So we were able to kind of look at that and go, okay, so this plan is working. It meant that we had to really reevaluate some of our planning processes as a coaching staff because we were going to have significantly less contact time on the field doing physically demanding work during preseason.
Well, that's good to hear. I love it when I hear the quality over quantity. I think that's what everybody needs to start to hear a lot more. You know, sometimes those double sessions are unavoidable, but if you're able to pull it off with shorter amount of time and still be successful, I think that's a real tribute to the staff and obviously to the whole program, just making things work like that.
Thank you very much. I mean, we went back at the end of our preseason phase and I looked at, we had last year's RPE-based trim. We had last year's first beat-based trim. Because we had first beat rolling for every session last year, we had time for sessions, like contact time on the field. And we were able to see that I think we did somewhere between 40 and 60% less contact work in our first week of preseason this year than we did previously.
Wow.
And it showed, like the decrease in hours was huge, you know, things like that. And then, I mean, we had a really fun exchange with our performance staff here where we were getting ready to play a scrimmage against the team and we took a photo of the lineups and looking at it, I said, geez, not a one of our girls is wrapped or worrying about an injury. And I'm looking over at our opponent who are a very high caliber team. And I think they had 7 or 8 like hamstring and quad wraps and things like that. And it showed in the game. I mean, we were the underdog going into the game and we were able to perform very, very well. And aspects of our play rather than our physical preparation were what let us down and didn't let us get the result that we maybe could have gotten on the day.
Well, I think it always helps when you can have your players on the field, right? And not have to worry about that. So.
And that's been a point of emphasis within the new performance model that we have here is that everything we do has a cost and is the action worth the cost?
No, that's a great point. I wanted to touch quickly on compliance. Everybody's favorite word here, but I mean more in the sense of we've talked about your roster with the international players, the seniors that'll be moving on. But when I noticed you do have 7 student athletes majoring in kinesiology, has this in any way helped with compliance or interest in the system? Can you just touch on that at all?
So it's actually really funny. I had 2 of the girls in my office on a Friday morning, and they were talking about how during their freshman year, which is the first year we started using First Beat, they interviewed me for a class they were having to talk about how we use First Beat and what we're using it for on the team. Since then, the professor that they had for that class came to the seminar we did with you guys here on campus and is doing a mini study on our team to compare VO2 max scores, max heart rate from a VO2 test, and RPE-based trim scores with First Beat. So like the girls are developing this academic-based interest in the system. We gave a lot of ownership to them. Like I see other programs where a session starts or ends and they put their monitors back in the team bag and the coaches are responsible for bringing that to and from the session. And that's just not who we are. The girls are responsible for wearing their monitor. That means they're responsible for putting it on when they leave the locker room, for putting it back in the locker room at the end of a session. And we have very, very few instances where they don't. And if they do, you know, we start a session, I look at the computer and I say, hey, I have 18 names. There's 22 of you here. Who am I missing? And if they don't know, I yell out their name and then we check and make sure that they're connected. And if they're not, you know, we put a little water on them and make sure they're good. As soon as that question's asked, if they know they're not wearing their monitor, there's like a puff of dust where they used to be and they're on their way into the locker room to go get it.
So it sounds like you've got a really good combination there of subjective and objective data with the players. You're getting a lot of good feedback. Seems like things are really going smoothly with that combination.
I mean, it's been an adjustment for sure. Over the years that we've been together, our mindset has shifted from being athletes who, you know, enjoy playing their sport to a more of a high performance mindset. And for that to happen, certain things need to happen. You need to pay attention to what you eat, you need to pay attention to how you're feeling. And we need to be able to have relatively honest conversations. Now, I'm not naive, I'm not foolish. I know that these are 18 to 22 year old young women who are at a pivotal age in their life where they are going to be doing things that, you know, they're going to want to have experiences that everybody has in college. But making sure that we understand the impact of those experiences on our body and on our recovery is key. Making sure that we as coaches are mindful of, hey, the team want to do this thing. Can we figure out a way to adapt that into our plan? And if we do, what's the impact going to be? That first season you talked about, the girls wanted to go on a walk around Philadelphia to go to a particular market. And we did it and we lost our game the next day. And I think that will stick with me for a long time, that we unnecessarily put a 4-mile walk into our legs on a Saturday on a day between games, in addition to a walkthrough. That was a lot of load to put on ourselves for no real point other than just to go and have an experience. If we want to have that experience, can we get there without the walk? Can we do that thing, but not have it be as physically taxing? I will have to say, and I said this to another company that we use for a video analysis piece, like the support that we've gotten from FirstBeat and the information and the way that it's helped our program to grow has been invaluable. And during the 4 years that we've been using the system, this program has taken steps forward that I don't think would have been possible if we hadn't been paying attention to the things that we are because of the product and because of the system that we're using and the information that we've been able to glean from what we do. A big piece of what we're trying to do is be more intentional and better prepared as coaches and athletes, and this allows us to do that.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah, it's been a great 4 years working with you guys, and we're just looking forward to more years, and definitely the best of luck for the rest of this season. Once again, Mark, just want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Always good to catch up with you.
Likewise, Ben. It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you very much. We got a couple weeks ahead of us, so let's keep it rolling.
All right, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, feel free to drop a review on iTunes and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to the FirstBeat Sports Podcast. For more information about us and our sports monitoring systems, give us a call at 435-363-9533, or you can send us an email to sports@firstbeat.com. You can also visit us online at www.firstbeat.com. Thanks a lot for listening today, and don't forget to be with us on the next edition of the FirstBeat Sports Podcast.